What I promised I would talk about yesterday, I think, was talk about some different types of meditation, because now's a very good time as we get into the meditation retreat, just to increase our repertoire, because I think you're getting the idea now that in order to develop sustained attention and to get success in your meditation, there is a certain sense of like entertaining the mind, giving it some joy, giving it some fun. And sometimes what you might find very useful is to try different types of meditation. It's actually the same basic process, but you're just using different objects to focus your attention on. And by using different objects to focus your attention on, it avoids the mind getting bored by just always plugging on the same track. It stops it also getting sleepy as well, because you find that a lot of sleepiness, a lot of sloth and torpor comes from boredom when you're always doing the same thing over and over and over again. So in my own practice, and how I like to teach others, is to also, especially when you're doing a lot of meditation, to cultivate a few different types and approaches to meditation. And it gives a variety which keeps the mind's interest, and also it does develop some different aspects of the mind which you'll find will be really, really helpful developing peaceful states of mind. And of course the first one I want to talk about is one of the most useful, is like doing metta meditation. It's like loving kindness meditation. And the way you do loving kindness meditation is by finding some objects in which you can cultivate this emotion of love, this emotion of kindness upon. The simile I often use is like lighting a fire, and you do need kindling to light a fire. You can't put a match to a big log and expect the match to ignite that log, and the log is far too big. So you have to find something which is easy to take the flame, something which is easy to light, whether it's some of these fire lighters you get for barbecues, or whether it's paper or straw, or anything which takes the fire very easily will do. And you build up the first flames of loving kindness on that kindling, and then later on you can put sort of more solid pieces of wood on it. First of all just twigs, and then branches, and then big logs you can put on that fire. It's always the case that only when there's a big heavy fire there, really strong and very hot, only then can you put on the big sappy logs. And the big sappy logs are your enemies, and sometimes for many of you the biggest sappy log of all is yourself. And that's when you can put on yourself on that the fire of loving kindness. And you find if the fire is very strong and large, you can dry out and ignite the biggest, sappiest logs of all. Even your worst enemies, you can give loving kindness towards. And sometimes it surprises you that you can actually do this. You think of this person who you always had anger to and wanted revenge, and you find you get yourself in a mind state which you can actually love them. You can really give them goodwill. And you're not playing around, it's actually happening. Again, it's because it's a gradual process of development of this emotion called loving kindness. Now, those kindling, as many of you know, the sorts of kindling which I've encouraged people to use, I personally just like using a small kitten. And just you imagine it, this is where you use your power of visualization together with your commentary. Here you encourage the commentary, but you keep the commentary just on a certain area. You're as it were psyching yourself up to develop like loving kindness towards a small visual object, an imaginary object. And again, don't be afraid of imagination, because visualizations and imaginations are a tool of the mind which you can use to your benefit. So imagine, if it's not a small kitten, some people like to use a puppy. One of the people in Sydney, when I said you could use a baby, they actually imagined themselves as a child when they were very young, you know, 1 or 2 years of age, or even younger than that. And they put they literally put themselves on their knee and spread loving kindness to themselves. And when you're actually spreading loving kindness includes compassion. And this is where we look at the suffering which that being can easily experience in the world. Just their vulnerability, the fact that they are subject to pain. Not just physical pain, but mental pain of loneliness and rejection. And the cold of the body, the cold of the heart. And when I do this with my little kitten, I always sort of think that there's no one else in the whole world except me to look after that small being. And if I don't look after it, if I don't take it in, I just imagine what sort of death that little being is going to have. Just cold, rejected, hungry, thirsty, sick. And when I start to see just the dukkha, the suffering in that being, and how that being is just so vulnerable to pain, then straight away it encourages in me the compassion towards that being, the sense of protection, the sense of looking after. And as soon as that compassion, that sense of looking after comes up, it gets very easy at the same time to have this loving kindness, which is basically goodwill. Compassion is goodwill towards someone who's suffering. And now it's goodwill to ease the suffering in that imaginary being, and even if they're not suffering, to make their happiness even more delightful. And so I deliberately get up feelings of goodwill, of kindness, of compassion, of love, of care. All of these words which is centering in on this concept of loving kindness. And I enter into a commentary with myself at this time, just imagining what might happen to that being, imagining looking after that being, saying like words of kindness, of protection towards that being, doing little imaginary exercises like getting eye contact with that being. Because when you actually can contact the imaginary being's eyes, whenever you have eye contact with another being, it becomes very emotional. And I just keep on developing sort of those images. I keep on continuing that commentary until such time that the loving kindness towards that imaginary being is really, really strong. You find, at least I find anyway, it's so much easier to light a fire of loving kindness on such easy kindling. First of all, it's a lovely furry animal. It's young and it's imaginary, so I can make it whatever I want. If it's actually real, even little kittens, when they're real, can sometimes be a pest. But if it's imaginary, you've got full control over it to make it as furry, as soft. It purrs at the right time and it doesn't sort of poo on your lap. So you can do everything you want just to make it just a very nice little being. Because it's imaginary, you've got control over it. So you're just using this as a means to develop loving kindness, to get it started. And like most of these meditations, as you go along, quite naturally you'll be aware of the feeling of loving kindness. When the flame starts to take and there's a fire starting, you can feel its warmth. Because loving kindness, when it gets started, is a very pleasurable emotion. And once you actually start to feel its warmth, then you really get into it. I should actually say that one of the retreatants in Sydney, she didn't really have empathy towards little animals, nor did she really like children. And so what she did, she was very innovative, and she'd just been planting some small flowers, some pot plants in her house. And so she just imagined that small seed under the earth. And just like the little kittens or the puppies, the seed is also a being which needs care and protection. And so she got all her like motherly instincts, which she didn't really have towards children, towards that little seed, and nurturing it, and just imagining it growing And when it was a young seedling, it was just so tender and so easily sort of hurt and broken, and had a long way to go before it was a fully fledged flower. And so just imagine, she imagined herself just nurturing this, protecting it, loving it, caring it for it, until such time that the little flower sort of burst forth and repaid her kindness with this really beautiful smile of a flower in bloom. And she really got off on that. That was actually, for her, it was the first time the meditation really worked. It was the first time when she wasn't waiting for me to ring the bell. And this was just another way of developing loving kindness, instead of towards an animal or a human being, towards even a plant. And you can do that. But the point is, as long as you're nurturing this emotion and making it grow, and again, you are allowed, and it's a good to use your commentary at this point to keep the fire burning. Because like sometimes when you put a match to a piece of paper, you've got to blow, you've got to fan, you've got to keep it going. Sometimes you need two or three matches to get it alight. But whatever, you work until it's going. And once it's going, you have to, with loving kindness meditation, always like experience the warmth from time to time. So you're working to get the fire going, but you're also pausing now and again to see the result of your work. And as you see the result of your work, it gives you the encouragement that something is happening. It's like a softening of the mind. And the mind is turning towards this emotion of like love and goodwill and care. It's becoming selfless, not so concerned with its own needs and lacks. It's becoming more in tune with the needs, with giving, with sharing towards some other being in this universe. The emotion, when it's begins to be generated like this, it feels very beautiful. And as you develop it more and more, that happiness of the emotion of loving kindness gets very, very strong. When it gets to the point that it's self-sustaining, like a fire is self-sustaining, it's got enough fuel on there, then that's when you don't need to keep on with the commentary of loving kindness. You can actually just go to its warmth, just the feeling of loving kindness. And this is where you'll know the feeling is usually centered around your chest, around your heart region. At least with me it is. And it's a very pleasant physical feeling. And it's a very pleasant mental feeling as well. It's very joyful to actually to give unconditioned love to another being, even though it's imaginary. And that sort of brings out the aspect of loving kindness, which is complete embracing of that being, you know, with full forgiveness, without any fault finding. When there is full loving kindness, the fault finding mind is completely transcended, and is that like accepting mind. And this becomes a very useful emotion to develop in the meditation. If you can develop a little bit of loving kindness meditation like this, then you're softening the mind, you're softening the heart, and you find that there is not so much fault finding, but there's more embracing. Fault finding is being critical, seeing part of the whole, especially the part which is wrong, whereas loving kindness embraces the unity of something. You accept the little kitten or little puppy exactly as they are. It embraces the forgiveness, its acceptance. And when you can develop this towards like a little puppy or a kitten or a flower, you find that when you do other meditations during the retreat, even meditation on the breath, you find you can be much more accepting of the process and not be so critical of the process. You won't be so fault-finding towards any slowness in the meditation. You won't be so fault-finding towards the moment, but you'll find you have much more contentment. You'll be able to embrace the moment as it is, rather than being aware of so much which is wrong in the moment. The whole attitude of mind is changing. The world is the world. It's what we add to it creates the difficulties and problems. We add the faults to the world, or we can add the acceptance to the world. It's really up to us. And here we're training the mind to look at the world in a completely different way. It's because we can develop the loving kindness meditation, the emotion of loving kindness, of embracing and forgiveness. Because we can do that, we can also transfer that loving kindness onto something like the breath. So that when you are watching the breath, you can watch it with loving kindness, with full embracing. You nurture it just as that little seedling. Then I find that if I can do loving kindness with breath meditation, it becomes a very, very powerful combination. Because loving kindness is avoiding the fault-finding mind and giving the ability to embrace the breath as it is. And the breath meditation is what's going to take me into deep and peaceful states. The deep states of meditation, the jhanas especially, are emotional states. They're not intellectual states. And if you want to develop those states, you have to be able to trust in the emotions. Sometimes, and I a bit facetiously say that the jhanas are feely-feely states, like the loving-kindness. Feely-feely. You've got to feel your way into these states rather than think your way in. And this is why when you do loving-kindness meditation with the breath, you're being able to add that emotional sensitivity to breath meditation. You'll be able to trust in that part of the mind which can feel and can delight in just a simple breath. So this is one of the reasons why it's very handy to do loving-kindness meditation, because it develops the emotional, the trust in your emotions. Secondly, of course, it gets rid of the fault-finding mind, and especially the hindrance of ill will, which can come up to all sorts of people, but especially to oneself. I mentioned that's one of the big hindrances to people attaining the great depths of meditation. They just simply don't allow themselves to. And they're too critical of themselves. They think, I can't do it, which is very close to ill will. Lack of self-esteem, lack of self-confidence is just right next door to ill will. So what loving kindness does in this sense, it sort of allows yourself to experience the very heights of meditation. It permits yourself to experience bliss, and it also gives you the confidence that you can achieve these things. So often it's the case, if a person thinks they can't achieve, they won't achieve. And if a person even doubts whether they can achieve this, they won't achieve. Someone is putting, or yourself, you are putting the obstacle in front of you, needlessly. So that loving kindness is like an encouraging. It frees you to achieve everything which is there to achieve in the world. So by doing that loving kindness meditation, especially if you can point it towards yourself, once you develop it with little imaginary animals, then you can make put real people in front of you, close friends, associates, family members. As long as you can still keep that fire of loving kindness going, as I say, you can put in the really big logs, ones which are hard to take the flame. You can put in wet sappy logs, and that way you can develop a lot of powerful love even towards your enemies. Then you find that you can forgive once that fire is very strong. Then much of the ill will towards oneself is because of a lack of forgiveness towards oneself. And that's why towards the end of a loving kindness meditation, that's when you really can put yourself on your knee, as it were, and give yourself complete forgiveness. You know what it says in the Metta Sutta, just like a mother loves her child, her only child. And this is what a mother does to her child. They love the child, give meaning, give full forgiveness. No matter what a child does in the world, they'll always be their mother's son or daughter. Never abandon their child. Even like little animals, you know that you've seen cats when they have kittens. Even the mother cat eats all of the kitten's feces. It licks them all, cleans them, all the dirt the mother sort of eats up. It's amazing sort of sacrifice the mother has towards her children. The amount of forgiveness, tolerance. And this is what we mean by that loving kindness, being able to accept and embrace and forgive everything. And that's an important part of the meditation, to develop that loving kindness to oneself to the point where one can completely forgive oneself, to the point where ill will is abandoned and overcome. Only then, when ill will is abandoned, can you give yourself goodwill. Can you wish yourself well? Can you allow happiness to come into you? Can you start to enjoy meditation? Because if there's ill will there, then it's such a huge obstacle which will come up in one stage or another of the meditation. It can sometimes, as they come up towards the breath, can sometimes come up towards the teacher, can sometimes even come up towards your meditation cushion. Stupid cushion. And all of that ill will is what's stopping you enjoying the meditation. So the loving kindness meditation is a very beautiful one to develop. And you can develop it at any time during this retreat. You don't have to be sitting meditation. You can do it while you're walking on the path, developing loving kindness in whichever way you can. But remember, try and develop it on simple objects first of all. Usually imaginary objects are the best. And then build it up until it's really, really strong. When you have very, very strong loving kindness, you can either then turn on to the breath if you wish, and you find the breath is just so easy to watch. Or if you just want to carry on with loving kindness and take that into a jhana, what you should do is just be able to see the fire of loving kindness without any fuel. The fuel is like the cat or the kitten, the puppy, etc., the person. And just have love, metta, as like a power, as a fire, or as a light, whichever you wish to imagine it. But no person giving out that metta, no being receiving it, just disembodied loving kindness, boundless loving kindness, the experience of loving kindness, what loving kindness actually is, rather than who it's aimed at. If you start to focus on what loving kindness actually is, rather than where it's coming from or where it's going to, then loving kindness by itself becomes a very beautiful object of meditation. You become aware of just metta. As I said, because it's a very beautiful object, it's inherently beautiful, but once it's generated, once the fire is there, it's not that difficult to sustain your attention on it, because it delights the mind. However, one of its difficulties that is it's not that stable at first. But if you can stay with loving kindness, it delights the mind, and try and calm it down, make it very peaceful and refined, then that experience of loving kindness itself will become your nimitta and can take you into a jhana, a metta jhana. Development of loving kindness is one of the ways into jhanas. But with all of these jhanas, you have to simplify what you're aware of, and it has to become a mental awareness, a mental object, not a physical awareness. So you develop loving kindness to that point. Then go into deep jhanas. Also, another way of doing loving kindness meditation is if you've done a lot of breath meditation and got a deep samadhi, not necessarily into jhanas, but at least some degree of samadhi, then you can take up loving kindness. If you find you've already developed a degree of deep meditation, samadhi, then when you take up loving kindness, it's just so easy to do. You've had a deep meditation, you start thinking about loving kindness. You can spread it to the whole world with just so easily, because the mind is soft. You can work with the mind once it's had some deep samadhi. What samadhi does to the mind, it's like the mind being a piece of clay, and if it's too dry, you can't make that mind, that piece of clay, into anything. And if it's too wet and soggy, it just goes all over the place. But if it's just the right amount of water in that clay, you can turn it into all sorts of shapes. And when there's just the right amount of water in the mind, that's just after deep meditation, you can turn it into anything. You can do beautiful loving kindness meditation. I remember once we used to do this chant in our monastery some time ago, the four Brahma Viharas. We do the chant of spreading loving kindness, the metta, and then compassion, and then sympathetic joy, and then equanimity. Now, all in about 5 minutes. And after one very nice meditation, and we started doing this chant, just I got stuck on the first one and I couldn't go anywhere else. And just because as soon as I started chanting, the mind was just so workable, as it were, so easy to point towards whatever I wanted to. But as soon as those words came up, just immense loving kindness, and just couldn't do anything else. You got stuck in loving kindness. But it really showed me it was really powerful loving kindness as well. It just shows what you can do with a mind which is well trained. You can really do loving kindness meditation. And I often thought that a lot of the loving kindness I did before was just really messing around, scratching at the surface. If you develop very nice mind states in just breath meditation, sometimes it's very good when you come out then to do loving kindness meditation and experience its power, experience its bliss, and do it to all beings, and also including yourself. Because your mind has been empowered, the loving kindness is extremely strong, and it can really do a lot of benefit towards yourself, a lot of benefit towards other beings. So those are some of the ways of doing loving kindness meditation, especially to overcome the hindrance of ill will, to be able to look at the breath and to nurture the breath by doing loving kindness on the breath, being able to give the mind something else to do in this meditation retreat, so you're not always doing breath meditation, and be able to sort of get these very beneficial attitudes of forgiveness towards oneself and all other beings, so one isn't carrying around the fault-finding mind which sees all the mistakes in oneself and other beings and the world. So those are the benefits of loving kindness. I want to go on now, because I wanted to talk about a few meditations today. One of the next meditations, which again people often talk about, and I've mentioned already that the Samatha meditation which we're doing here always goes along with Vipassana, but now I wanted just to spend a few words about insight meditation, and how that I encourage you to do insight meditation as you go along, calming the mind. Whenever you're going through these stages of meditation, as I've been teaching the last few days, whenever there's a difficulty, whenever there's like a blockage, whenever you seem to not be proceeding like as fast as you should be, then that's the time to really stand back and look and see what is going on. At each of these blockages in your meditation, these are places where you start to develop insight. And when we talk about insight meditation, you can have insight into all sorts of things in this world. this endless amount of phenomena to understand in this thing we call existence. But here I mean insight into the way of meditation, insight into the way you work, your attitudes towards meditation, your attitudes towards the meditation objects, the attitudes towards your success and failure. This is where you're getting insight into some personal characteristics, some of the nature of your mind and your body. And these are the insights which you'll find extremely beneficial to your happiness, and also on the by the side, and your ability to meditate. Whenever you get any difficulty, don't just keep on going the same way. Stand back and look what you're doing. See if you can find out what the obstacle is. The other day I gave a talk on the five hindrances. The Buddha said that whatever obstacle it is in your meditation, it will be one or more of those five hindrances. So whenever you do get a blockage in the meditation, stop, using the framework, the teaching of the five hindrances, see if you can identify which hindrance it is, or which combination. If it's a combination, there will still be one hindrance, which is the dominant one. Whether it is ill will, or whether it's restlessness, or whether it is laziness, sloth and torpor. So whenever you come to a blockage, stop, and using the framework of the five hindrances, identify the problem. Because once you've identified the problem, that you should have remembered some of the skillful means to overcome that particular hindrance. If you stop at an obstacle and you look very clearly, sometimes you can see, say for example, ill will, and you never imagine ill will would be there. Insight, if it's good insight, will always surprise you. You'll see something you did not expect. You realize it's ill will was the main obstacle at this particular stage in the meditation. So what should you do? No fault finding, a bit of loving kindness, a bit of embracing, a bit of softness in the mind, not the hardness. And if you try the antidote to the problem, usually in meditation, straight away it works or it doesn't work. If you get it right, if you really have seen the obstacle and you apply the antidote, almost immediately the obstacle disappears and you go into deep meditation. It's amazing, just the application of insight in your meditation practice, which you'll find will be one of the most powerful tools to developing depth in meditation. Certainly that's my experience. Sometimes I'm sitting here, don't seem to be getting anywhere, and then I stop and look, why? What's going on? And I identify the fault very quickly, and as soon as I've identified it, just actually with the identification, as if the antidote comes along automatically, and the obstacle's gone, and you go into really deep meditation. And it's just so powerful and so wonderful to see that you're not that far from deep meditation. Just a blockage which you're not seeing. That's all. So you identify it with the five hindrances. Which particular one it is? Is it doubt? I can't do this. I know this is not the right thing for me. That's doubt. That's the hindrance. Counter that with just confidence, with sadha, with faith in what the Buddha taught. Even do a reflection of the qualities of the Buddha, which is sometimes what I do in my meditation. And as soon as I start to reflect on the qualities of the Buddha, straight away doubt disappears. You get like confidence, you get faith. These are little antidotes which you can use to counter some of the problems which arise in meditation. But the important thing is you're getting insight into those problems. You're not just trying to push them over standing back and looking what they are first of all. When you find out what they are, you apply the antidote and you find that these things are indeed an obstacle to peace. As you go along, you also experience the what it's like to have an obstacle, and also what it's like when the obstacle is removed. You're starting to understand why these things are conducive to dukkha. You have something like craving, which the Buddha said was the cause of dukkha. In your meditation, this is an obstacle there. Sometimes you can identify it as craving, which is a combination of quite a few hindrances. The first hindrance, it could be sensory desire, it could be restlessness, craving for something else. It can be ill will, not happy with what you're experiencing, so you're craving for something different. But you can identify it as craving, you can see what that does to the mind. I really want to get into jhana. I really want to sort of get rid of this terrible meditation I'm having. Whatever it is, that just to stand back and notice it. And straight away, everyone here knows enough of the teachings to realize or remember straight away, craving is conducive to suffering. So straight away, just knowing that, you should be able to let go of that craving, let go of that demand. And strangely it may seem, the craving disappears once you recognize it. Once you recognize it as your obstacle, it's gone. You let go. And once you let go, the mind becomes again very peaceful. You're using the insight into finding the obstacles to deep meditation and just overcoming them. It might be the chattering mind, which is your obstacle. Again, this mostly restlessness creates that chattering mind. Also a little bit of doubt, a lack of confidence in the method. So you're having to keep on giving yourself instructions all the time, because you doubt whether you can just do it without keeping control. And once you actually see that, and you see the cause of this, coming from this obsession with controlling, always wanting to be the one in command of this meditation, always giving orders, but willing to let go and allow meditation to happen, not willing to be a passenger, but always giving orders. Once you actually see the problem, you can have so many skillful means to overcome it. Imagine yourself being the passenger in a car. Imagine the person who's driving this car is this big 7-foot football player, and if you give any orders, he's going to slug you. Shut up, he says to you. So you daren't say anything. You daren't give any orders. And he's also a very good driver. Or you can imagine yourself in an aircraft. Wherever it is where you know that you're helpless, you can't do anything. You're passive, you're a passenger. And if just even imagining yourself in the role of a passenger means that you don't give orders, and straight away, if you have that perspective on your meditation, the perspective of the passenger, the commentary, the chatter starts to disappear. If you always remember that there's no need to assess this meditation while you're doing it. You wait till the end to assess meditation, not during the process. You wait till the examination is finished before you mark it, not in the middle of it. And if you remember that, you will not always be sort of checking up on yourself to see how you're doing. You won't always be sort of criticizing yourself. The commentary will have no place to stand. So you use by insight, what is this obstacle, this commentary, or this sleepiness, all this inability to go deep in meditation, just stand back and look at it and see if you can find which hindrance it is. And once you identify it, you're identifying a character trait in yourself. You're identifying a cause of suffering in yourself, because you'll find it's not just how you meditate. You find that same character trait manifests in how you live your life. If you can see it as an obstacle in your meditation, you'll always be able to see it as an obstacle in your life. It doesn't just obstruct peace and depth in your meditation. It obstructs peace and depth in your life. You're getting to the heart of some of the causes of your personal suffering. If it's ill will in your meditation, you find you have ill will in your life. If you have an inability just to be content with the moment in meditation, you'll have the inability to be content in life. If you're always so critical in the meditation, you'll always be so unforgiving in life. So this is insight which really gets to the heart of things. And you actually gain this insight on your meditation cushion. That's why I said before, a bad meditation, such a word does not exist. If you have a blockage in meditation, a difficult meditation, it means there is something for you to learn. There's an opportunity for insight, so-called bad meditations. However, you can waste such meditations by not using them wisely. You have a difficulty come up in a meditation, don't call it a bad meditation, call it an opportunity for insight. Look at that blockage, examine it, find out which hindrance it is, what combination, and test out the antidotes and see if they work. If they do work, that's what ill will means, if metta solves the problem. So this is how one can do insight meditation, and especially when you get to the deeper stages of this meditation, when you start getting nimittas coming up. Why is it I can't hold those nimittas? What's the hindrance there? And this is where you have like these beautiful insights of fear, you know, the origin of fear, because the origin of fear is possessiveness. When you own things, you're always afraid to let go. The more you own, the more you have to fear. And this is an insight into the nature of self. The more you can understand you own nothing, you have nothing, you are nothing, the easier it is to let go. And this is actually what you're doing at these stages of the meditation, to be able to hold on to that nimitta. You have to let go of the doer. You have to let go of control. You have to let go of the idea you own all of this and you're in control of this. And this is where you get some very powerful insights into non-self. It's also where you get some very powerful insights into dukkha, into suffering. Because here, you can actually, very often meditators, when a nimitta comes up, they can see that's really beautiful, that's blissful in there. So if they're looking through a window that's just pure bliss, they just can't get through that window or go through that door. And they ask themselves, why am I staying here with dukkha? What actually is dukkha? What actually is sukha? Why in here is it suffering? Why over there in these jhanas is it so much bliss? Because you're letting go of body. You're letting go of the senses.